Welcome to episode 11 of the Harry Potter Lexicon podcast. My name is Steve Vander Ark, and I'm the creator and editor-in-chief of the Harry Potter Lexicon website. And today we're going to talk a little bit more about Harry Potter canon. We're going to focus today on Book 5. But before we get to that, a few other things to talk about. One of them is we have some new information coming out on Pottermore. We have a new book. I guess you'd call it a book, called The Book of Spells, which is coming out, which sounds absolutely fascinating. So let's talk about that a little bit. First of all, Pottermore. I've been exploring it again, which I keep doing over and over, and noticed something which probably many of you have noticed already, but I just thought I'd bring it up just because it's one more aspect of the site that just amazes me in a way, is the depth of the sound on each what they call a moment. If you follow through, if you go from one level to the next by double clicking and you move through, you'll notice that on most of the pages the sounds actually change, so that as you kind of delve into the scene, you hear other things. So not only do you see more, which you'll notice if you a good example is the when Hagrid is arriving, that scene, as you go deeper into the scene, the image of Hagrid on the motorcycle appears in the sky, where before it looked, well, it kind of looked like some clouds. But as you kind of focus deeper into the scene, you see that it's actually Hagrid. Well, the sound also focuses, it changes as you go deeper into the site. Just really fascinating, and just an example of how much care they're putting into this website, and how much detail. This is not being done, you know, in a sloppy way at all. It's the experience just keeps getting better and better. I know I found a couple of new books. I don't know if I mentioned that last time around, but a couple of new spell books that I discovered with some new information, and I really wasn't sure whether I'd found them before or whether those were things that were added. And from the conversations I've had online, it seems that those were things which were added later. I went through the whole site when I first got access, which is months and months ago, and kind of figured I'd found everything. And it's really interesting now to discover that there are new things hidden away. Yet the one thing I kept thinking, though, is I really would like to go through the whole thing again. I'd like to be able to start over. You can't do that. I mean, you're not allowed to create a new user. That's not allowed by the terms of service. And so you don't ever get a chance to go back and start again. And, you know, I don't care so much about being sorted again or any of that kind of thing. I'm really not, I don't want to find galleons again so that I add to my galleon store. I mean, I've got enough that I can buy what I need to buy in Diagon Alley. It's more a matter of just experiencing it again. And I wish that now that I've gotten to the end of book one, I'd like there to be a reset button, as in reset the experience and just go through it again, explore it again, find those little things again, even if they don't count, even if you don't get to have more stuff out of the deal, just an opportunity to go through and do it all over again. Because now when I go to a page, sometimes I'll remember, oh yeah, there was a galleon there, or oh, I found an item here, or a famous wizard card. And it would be fun to do that again, even if it didn't, as I said, if it didn't count. So maybe at some point we'll get that opportunity. I do know that they're working on Chamber of Secrets. They've said that, and that's going to be coming out and added before too long, which I think is fantastic. I'm looking forward to that, obviously. But in the meantime, a couple other things I discovered, and this is actually not a Pottermore thing, although it connects to it in a way. This is something which I guess I have to attribute to the fact that I was kind of out of circulation for a bit there when I was teaching. And now that I'm digging back into the world of Harry Potter and kind of re-immersing myself, one of the things I discovered, to my sadness, was that J.K. Rowling's website is changed. Apparently it changed back in April, which probably many of you listening are going, well, duh, we saw that ages ago and we've talked about it, but I didn't, so I'm going to talk about it now. It's a beautiful site, and I understand it's there for promoting the new book, which is coming out, the non-Harry Potter book. And it's, I guess, more less of a Harry Potter experience and more of a, this is J.K. Rowling, all the things that she's interested in and that she's supporting, and you can do a timeline of when everything came out, books and films and things, and which is wonderful. But boy, I'm sad to see the desk disappear and the little Easter eggs. And it was described, I think this was on Yahoo, as not having the Easter eggs or whimsy of the old version, which I think is very sadly true. It's not intended to be that, and I understand kind of why it is what it is, but it is sad to never be able to go back and mess around with all that stuff and wonder about what's going to be behind that mysterious door and things like that. And how that ties to Pottermore is, I guess, that what I'm hoping is that some of that whimsy and so is kind of put into Pottermore. So far, really hasn't happened. Everything in Pottermore is very much tied directly to what's in the books, so if you know what's in the books, for the most part, you're not going to be surprised or anything by what's on Pottermore. Now, of course, that's not true. If you've been there or if you've heard about it, you know perfectly well there's a lot of new material there, which is new and exciting and interesting and fun to read. And so there is new material, but it doesn't have quite that same sense of discovery, I guess. And once you found it, and there you go. You don't check the site every day in case there's something new, the way that we used to do on Rowling's original website. So that is kind of sad, I guess. I'm sorry to see it go. I wish it was archived somewhere that we could still take a look at it, but maybe sometime that'll be added to Pottermore. You never know. Moving on beyond that, I've noticed also there's a new book coming out, The Book of Spells, which is sort of a book. It's more of a video game, I guess. What's sad for me is that I have a feeling this is one book that I will never be able to read. In order to read this book, in order to find out, you know, all the new information she has about some of the spells and things, I guess I would have to get a PlayStation 3, which I'm not likely to get anytime soon. So this is going to be one piece of Harry Potter canon, which is going to forever, I guess, stay out of my reach, which is kind of sad. I hope that somewhere along the line, this information finds its way onto Pottermore or something like this, so that those of us that can't afford to buy video game, you know, consoles just to read a Harry Potter book, we'll still have access to it. It's interesting, though. I was reading the promotional information. It said, and I'm going to read from what it said, "In the world of Harry Potter, the Book of Spells is 200 years old and is written by Miranda Goshawk. This powerful spell book is kept in the restricted section of the Hogwarts Library." Now, that doesn't fit with the Book of Spells that is written by Miranda Goshawk and which appears starting in Philosopher's Stone. That particular book, or series of books, appears, well, as a series, one for each year at Hogwarts, or at least, I guess we don't know if there are, you know, level or for books for the seventh year, because Harry didn't actually attend in the seventh year, so we don't know what the books would have been. But for all the other years, he had to have a copy of the Book of Spells, you know, for each year. And so this particular Book of Spells may be the source material for those spell books that Miranda Goshawk wrote and which all of the Hogwarts students use as reference. Certainly, I don't think that the original Book of Spells, 200-year-old Book of Spells, was written by Miranda Goshawk, at least not unless Rowling is, you know, making a change to what's already given in canon, because according to Goshawk's famous wizard card, she was born in 1921 and is still alive. So it certainly was not a book that she would have written 200 years ago. But, you know, you have to realize that it could be that Rowling is saying, well, she's changing that particular fact. That certainly is not the first time she's done that. She has, you know, the famous wizard cards were written by her, and I would consider those to be canon because they were things she's written, and much of that information has appeared in other places since. But in the case of a few of them, things have changed. You know, as time goes on, as the books came out, well, that's true of things actually in the books themselves. There are contradictions in the books. Well, for example, and this is a minor thing, but it just gives you an example, the International Statute of Wizarding Secrecy, which according to Quidditch Through the Ages and the third Wombat test from the Rowling website and Fantastic Beasts, and Pottermore went into effect, was signed in 1692. But in both Deathly Hallows and Tales of Beetle the Bard, it says 1689. Now, of course, we can, as we like to do, go into the, inside the story and say, well, this is a very, very momentous piece of legislation. It did not just happen overnight. It was months and months of work by the Convention of Wizards that put this together. And so perhaps it was actually a course of, over the course of a number of years that this actually came into effect. But what it's actually saying, let's just be honest here, is in one place it says one date, and in other places it says another. And those, I guess some would say, well, the Deathly Hallows quote being primary canon, if you will, takes precedent, and it's 1689. But if that was the case, then you'd think that 1689 would have been what it would be on Pottermore. So I say that only as an example of the fact that, every tiny little detail and every tiny little fact, even those that we consider canon, even those that we have kind of like to consider to be set in stone, are not necessarily so. And, Rowling could very well have decided, well, I'm going to take the Book of Spells, which is mentioned in the books, and I'm going to put a little background to them. And in the process, yeah, I may have to change something about what I said 10 years ago on a famous wizard card, but that's okay. And of course, it is okay. She can do that by all means. So, Miranda Goshawk, at this point, we still consider to be born in 1921. And the Book of Spells that's in the restricted section, I would consider to be her source material, that she wrote the modern versions of that going back to the original 200-year-old source. That's the way I would read that. So, but we'll see. I mean, those are the kinds of things which, as time goes on, and when that Book of Spells actually becomes available for those lucky people who have a PlayStation 3 and a Move controller, maybe we'll get a little more information and find out that that Rowling has decided to essentially change canon at this point, which she's certainly entitled to do. Moving on, before we get to Book 5, as always, I'm going to poke around a little bit in the lexicon book, which just to point it out, that book is available yet on Amazon. I'm hoping this summer to make it available as an e-book on Amazon, on the Kindle, and also on the Nook. So watch for that. I'm working on the editing of that right now, along with the next reader's guide, which is for Chamber of Secrets, which I have run into again. And I know I talked about this back when we talked about Book 2, but I'm still trying to make sense of what Dobby actually knows at the beginning of Book 2. And I've had some people coming back and forth on that, discussing that with me, what they think is going on there. And I think confusion has... I've got some good input from some other fans has helped me to kind of piece it together, but I'm still stuck. One of the big things that really throws me is that Dobby knows that Harry, just a couple of weeks before, remember, this is only about 3 or 4 weeks later, had a run-in with Voldemort. And nobody knew that. Nobody, the Death Eaters certainly did not know that Voldemort was back in some form. I mean, if you think Lucius Malfoy knew that and then still gave away the diary, that doesn't make any sense. As a matter of fact, if you read in Half-Blood Prince chapter 23, when Dumbledore is speculating about the diary, he says that the reason Lucius Malfoy decided to send the diary off to Hogwarts to kind of put the old plan of Voldemort's into effect, only in this case for Lucius' own ends, he was doing that assuming that his master, his Dark Lord from 10 years before, was dead and gone. So how in the world did Dobby know that Harry had a run-in with Voldemort? I mean, the students don't know this. I mean, they all assumed, and Dumbledore even says that it was between, that the conflict, whatever happened, was between Quirrell and Harry. And so it's interesting. And again, we can step out of the story and say, well, that was a a plot. At the time, it made sense, but as the story, you know, the books progressed, didn't quite fit anymore, which may explain why it even turns up in Half-Blood Prince 23, is because if you think about it, in Chamber of Secrets, the description of the diary doesn't really match the description of Horcruxes starting in Book 6. We've talked before about how Books 2 and 6 really do connect. In lots and lots of ways, there are little mirrors, some of them small and some of them large. But it's great fun to pick those things out. But one of them, of course, is the fact that Horcruxes turn up in both. But the Horcrux, the diary Horcrux, is so different in its behavior. And I wonder if, as the story progressed, certainly Rowling clearly knew about Horcruxes when she was writing Book 2. But I'm not saying she had the name picked out yet, but she certainly knew this concept. I don't know that she quite had all the details worked out to the point that she had to work them out when she actually wrote Book 6. And I think it's possible that part of writing Book 6 then was looking back at Book 2 and saying, okay, that doesn't quite fit, so how can I kind of explain it? And so I think maybe that little conversation in Chapter 23 of Book 6 was her way of trying to fit those things together, which might also explain a little bit why there's a slight disconnect between what's going on in Book 2 and kind of the way the final story turned out. And, you know, that's just me. Some people say, oh my goodness, it's perfectly fine that he knew that. I just like to speculate on that. I like to wonder and try to think, you know, what was really going on there? And I'll tell you, one of the big things that really comes to mind is that there were other beings that knew about Voldemort, and those were the Centaurs. And on one hand, you think the Centaurs, well, they don't talk much, they don't discuss much, they don't have that much input into what's going on in wizarding society. But I can easily imagine that the Centaurs had, you know. And not just the Centaurs, but various magical beings, sentient magical beings in the wizarding world or in that universe or that sub-world, if you will, do communicate with each other. And even though they don't talk to the wizards very much, they do talk to each other. And I almost get this impression of this hidden subculture of beings having conversations and communication and discussions outside of the knowledge of the wizarding community, and one of the few wizards who would even be aware of that is Dumbledore, because he makes an effort to connect up with these other beings. Even Hagrid pays really no attention to anything that the Centaurs say. He considers them all just sort of ruddy stargazers, he calls them. He doesn't pay any mind, even when they're telling him things which he really should listen to sometimes. But Dumbledore does. Dumbledore can speak Mirmish. Dumbledore talks with the Centaurs. I mean, what a conversation he must have had to rescue Umbridge and to get Ferenczi to come and teach at the school. I mean, he must have, you know, long conversations. And so I can imagine that there's this other level of conversation going on in the wizarding world. And don't forget that house elves are some of the most powerful magical beings that we see in the wizarding world. The only reason that they don't totally dominate is the fact that they are themselves enslaved and totally dominated by the wizarding community. So, you know, they are absolutely, their capabilities are such that we really don't know what they can do and what they can't do. We do know that they can do whatever they want, in a sense. I mean, if you look at the fact that Dobby and the other house elves can clearly apparate within Hogwarts, wizarding, you know, spells and defensive magic means nothing to them. Think about the fact that Creature, when he accompanied Voldemort to the cave, and Voldemort left him there to die, and he just went back home. Voldemort's defenses meant nothing to him. He had been ordered to go back home, so he did. So clearly they have a lot of powers that we don't know, and that right there could explain it all away. How come he knew what was going on? I wanted to talk a little bit. Last time around, I talked about finding Diagon Alley in Cecil Court in off of Charing Cross Road, and I mentioned something which my impression of Charing Cross Road was that it was an extremely Muggle place. And it's interesting because I had a wonderful email from a listener named Vicky Hurst. She wrote, she lives in London. She walks down Charing Cross Road every day. And she has a very different take on it, which I thought was fabulous. She mentioned the fact, as I did, the fact that there are a lot of bookstores on Charing Cross Road. And even points out that back before this current time when publishing industry is kind of in recession, that really was the hub of the center of the publishing world in England. And here I'm going to read from her email because this is just such a great comment that she made. She said, "It occurred to me that of course Rowling would choose this place as the entrance to a magical world. Doesn't every reader know that the entrance to any world, any time, any fantasy or history or magic lies inside a book? You just have to find the right book, like finding the right brick to tap. Books can take you anywhere." What a fabulous, fabulous concept. And I think that's perfect. That's exactly right. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if that is, in fact, why Rowling chose Charing Cross Road as the location of the Leaky Cauldron and the doorway through that brick wall into Diagon Alley. So thank you, Vicky, for that email. And just by all means, several times now I've brought up in this podcast just how much how great it is to have these conversations and bounce ideas off of fans and listen to other people's ideas and theories and ways of looking at things, because I think we've all experienced this fact that we never seem to reach the end of things to talk about. We never seem to have delved deeply enough to get to the point where we say, okay, we've pretty much finished off, you know, everything there is to say about Harry Potter. You know, I'm famous for saying that I've read each book 50 times, and, you know, that's actually pretty close to true. I think it is true, especially in the earlier books. And I started reading book 5 again because, you know, I'm researching for this podcast, actually. And I've struck again. I posted this on Facebook. It just amazes me how the richness of Rowling's writing and the world that she created. And I say that, we'll talk about that more in a minute. I do want to talk about a couple of the things about the letter D before we get there. So let me save that. But let me just say a couple of little tiny details that jump out. And I love to do this because, you know, when I work on the lexicon, everything is organized by theme. And honestly, the lexicon is a very old website in internet terms. It was created, you know, back in 1999, which is, you know, 13 years ago, which is, as far as the internet is concerned, is ancient history. And back then, every page was hand-coded in HTML. Nowadays, of course, if you look at, like, the Harry Potter Wiki, which is a wonderful, wonderful website, they can edit this thing so much more quickly, and they can use the modern technology of a content management system to be able to just put new material in and have it connect up, and it's fabulous stuff. We didn't have that with the lexicon, and we still don't, because, well, for one thing, I'm the only one working on the lexicon right now, but also it's all there already in HTML, and I don't have it doesn't exist in a wiki form or in a easily editable form. Every time I edit a page, I have to literally go in and edit the page. So if something changes, if there's I had an email from someone who pointed out the spelling error when we had entered Twilfit and Tattings, the store, the clothing shop, that we had accidentally only put one T on Twilfit. And, well, for me, that's fine. I have to go into that page. I edit the word Twilfit. I edit the anchor for that, which is a HTML tag which allows you to jump to that directly. I have to edit the listing on the top of the page. I have to search through the entire lexicon to see where else it was possibly mentioned and change the spelling if it's in an essay or whatever. And that's just one tiny little reference. Every time I edit something, I have to do that. And it takes a really long time. And I don't mind doing it. In fact, I love doing it, which is why I do this. But I've had a lot of people say, why don't you put in the meaning of the names and the words and things? And I talked about this before. At the time when we were creating the lexicon, there was another website that was doing that, and I didn't want to take away from what they were doing. Back then, every one of the websites, and there weren't that many, but at least the ones that were, you know, fairly well known, we all kind of had our own little niche, and I didn't want to step on someone else's toes. I wanted them to be able to do what they did, and I just linked to it. And I've said that before, but now people say, well, you should put that information on the lexicon. So where does the word Dobby come from, for example, since we're talking about book two? And it's interesting because when I wrote the book, the lexicon book, which is an A to Z arranged guide, like an encyclopedia, a quick reference encyclopedia, I put in where all these words came from. And I would love to start putting that information onto the lexicon website itself. But as you can tell from what I just described, that would not be a very easy thing to do. I can't simply add a field and start typing. I have to actually go in and do a whole lot of editing. So I guess if you want to find out where a lot of these words come from, a good place to go would be the lexicon book. But I'll tell you one of them that, again, when I'm looking at the book and I'm looking in the letter D, and I looked up, I was seeing the word Dobby, and where that comes from, this is not an invention of Rowling. And as a matter of fact, I think I've said this before on this podcast, pretty much every creature and thing that is in the Harry Potter series comes from somewhere else. And it's not true of all of them. Blast-ended Scroots are blast-ended Scroots, and Rowling completely invented those. But a Dobby is actually, and this is a quote, it is a brownie or a house elf. And that's not a Rowling house elf, that's just the word, what it says. And it comes from Yorkshire and Lancashire folklore. Dobbies are helpful spirits who inhabit houses, as opposed to boggarts, who are also similar, but they are more meddlesome and more of a pest, and people have been known to have to leave their homes entirely to get away from a boggart, and boggarts have been known to follow and climb aboard the wagon and move along with the poor people who are afflicted by them. But it's just interesting how as Rowling is creating her world, she reaches into this rich history of legends and folklore and things. Some of them, I think we talked last time about the fact that she likes to go into things like the Loch Ness Monster and the Bermuda Triangle and some of what we would now consider to be more verging on urban legend or fairly, you know, recent legends and things like this. But a lot of them come from, you know, from some pretty, you know, distant past places. And so that's just an example of one of the things that she's done. Another thing I wanted to bring up is something, and this is, you know, I did mention the fact that sometimes canon will contradict itself. And, you know, that's a nice way of saying that Rowling doesn't always match up. I guess, to be fair, the fact that it almost always does is pretty amazing when you consider that the sheer scope of the world that she's creating. The fact that there are so few of these errors is astounding. You have to think, people have said, well, you know, if you read Tolkien, I mean, it all fits together, but Tolkien edited and revised for his entire life. And so the reason it all fits together is as he would write more books, he'd go back and revise to make it all fit. But just as an example of the way things come together, if you will, and, yeah, minor errors, but dragon pox. Now, if you know, for many people, that you immediately think of dragon pox, and you think of Alpheus Doge, who had dragon pox. This is book 7, and he was, when he first came to Hogwarts way back at the beginning of the 1900s, and Dumbledore was a classmate of his, and Alpheus Doge had suffered from dragon pox. He was over it, but he still had a green and purple face, and green and purple, by the way, if you've read on Pottermore the bit about clothing, here's a quote from Pottermore: "Wizards at large in the Muggle community may reveal themselves to each other by wearing the colors of purple and green, often in combination." So purple and green are wizard colors. So anyway, purple and green are also Dragonpox colors. But Dragonpox first turns up in the Daily Prophet newsletters. And it's on the problem page. And this is actually in the third of the four newsletters. And it says, I'm just going to read it to you because this is great stuff. It says, "Dear Problem Page, I have recently noticed a nasty green and purple rash between my toes, coupled with sparks from my nostrils when I sneeze. Should I be alarmed? Yours sincerely, Howland Koopy." And the response from Professor H. Spleen, who answers the medical questions on the problem page: "Dear Howland, it sounds to me as though you may have contracted dragon pox. You will find that it disappears of its own accord. In the meantime, immerse your nose continually in ice-cold water." Now, it's interesting because this is from 1999. This is when this was written by Rowling. Now, shortly thereafter, 2 years thereafter, I guess that's not that shortly, she wrote the famous wizard cards. And one of them was a wizard by the name of Chauncey Oldridge, who was born in 1342. His card says that he was the first victim of dragonpox. Now, that's where the slight inconsistency comes in, because if you've read Quidditch Through the Ages, you'll remember that it's mentioned, this is in the 1100s, that somebody who's supposed to play a game of Quidditch, in that case spelled K-W-I-D-D-I-T-C-H, but Quidditch was out with dragonpox. So apparently there was a known victim well before, and dragonpox itself was well known well before 1342. But and the humpbacked witch, whose statue stands in Hogwarts, that's Gunhilda of Gorsemore. According to her famous wizard card, she discovered the cure for dragonpox around 1600. So all of these little bits kind of fit together, and it's just fun to see this. And of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't remind us all that Draco Malfoy's grandfather, Abraxas Malfoy, died of dragonpox. So even though back in 1999 she wrote that it disappears of its own accord, by the time it turned up in a few other places in canon, we discover that it's maybe not quite such a simple illness after all. And of course, we step out of the story, but then we can also step into the story and say, well, Chauncey Oldridge was the first known victim of dragonpox, but who knows when, you know, the original manuscript that became part of Quidditch Through the Ages was discovered. Maybe at that point, they hadn't discovered that document yet. Or maybe there's different versions of dragonpox. Who knows? But the point of it is, it's just fun when you research things like this and you start looking through all the different sources that we have. It's fun to find something like dragonpox and then look at it and say, okay, she thought it up in 1999 as just almost a throwaway as part of this part of the Daily Prophet newsletters. But then, that was a great thing, kind of tuck that away. Next time she needed somebody to be sick, she could pull out dragonpox because she'd thought that up. So it's great fun to do that, and that, I guess, is an example, yes, of possibly a slight continuity error, but more to the point, it's an example of, as I said, the richness of this world that Rowling has created, the way that things are not just thrown in there and then they disappear, but you continually run into them over and over. I mean, for example, dragonpox is mentioned on the room guides or the floor guides for the hospital for St. Mungo's. If you look at that, one of the, I think the second floor is where you go if you're suffering from dragonpox. So, anyway, just one more example, and this over and over as I go through the lexicon, the website, because I do read the website, because I just love all these details. And as I have researched the book, and as I go back into the book now, it's just so much fun to explore and enjoy the richness of Rowling's writing, which takes me into book five. Because, like I said, I had the sad task, and I say that in big air quotes, of having to research this podcast, which meant starting to read book five again. And I started from the beginning, and I tell you, I got two or three chapters in, and just, what an amazing world. No wonder we were all, and still are, all so fascinated by these books. One thing that struck me immediately, again, is just how believable Harry's anger is in the book. And partly, I know, we're inside his mind. But if you go back to the film, they just quickly zap through it. I almost get the impression they're writing the script and saying, oh, okay, here's a bit, got to have him mad. Okay, let's make him mad. All right, let's keep moving. But when you read it, when you see it develop from his sitting there on that swing in the playground at the very beginning, all the way through the Dementors crashing into his world and his frustration and his anger, which in the book extends over weeks. It's not just one, you know, event. Even after the Dementor attack, it's still like a day or two before the party shows up to rescue him. It just goes on and on. And no wonder he's upset. And if you read the part where he's finally in Grimmauld Place, and he's angry, and of course Fred and George, as we see in the film, pop up, and we thought we heard your dulcet tones, and well, I don't know about you, but when I was watching the film, I thought, well, he wasn't really yelling. How'd you hear him? Because he didn't. He didn't scream at anybody. But if you read the book, there's whole sentences in all caps because he's hollering and shouting at poor Ron and Hermione. He's like out of control. And so you've got to read book 5 in order to really understand what's going on with Harry. And honestly, you have to understand what's going on with Harry because that is the point of book 5. We've been talking about each book. What is the purpose of each book? And book 5 is so critically important, which is why I think, you know, we were talking about it on the Facebook page. And if you want to join these discussions, I mean, the Facebook page link is on the show notes. So if you want to go in there and join in, by all means do so, because we've really been talking about some interesting things on there. But people right away say, oh, book 5 is my favorite. And, you know, the funny thing is, remember last time we were talking about the fact that most of us who were fans at that time and had studied all 4 books and were the fans who talked about it and delved into it, we really lost the, how did I put it, literal sense? No, linear sense, I think is the word that I used. Linear sense of story. We were not reading from one book to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. There was always a huge break in between. So for us, with that big gap that we talked about last time, we really were not still like on the precipice at the end of book 4. We had been through books 1, 2, 3, 4 over and over at that point, you know. And so when we got book 5, it was really jarring on a number of levels. For one thing, as I talked about last time, the fan community had just grown so in those couple of years. And the world itself, with the release of 2 films and a lot of material, products and things like this, games and whatnot, the world had really come to know about Harry Potter. And book 5, the anticipation was huge. The book parties were astounding. I mean, they're massive. I mentioned that for Goblet of Fire, there were book parties. I stood in line, I got my book, I went home. Well, for book 5, things had changed enough in the fan community that I was one of the people, you know, handing out the books and speaking and talking with people. I mean, by this time had discovered the Lexicon website. And so it was fascinating. When I got a hold of that book, it's funny because we all looked at it, and I think I read the very first chapter, but I didn't read more than that. I actually went home and went to bed, which you might think is utterly crazy, but I was actually on the Today Show the next morning. And so I didn't want to be up all night and then be on the Today Show and sound like an idiot. So I actually went to bed because I had to get up pretty early. And when I was on the show, they asked, well, did you finish the book? And I just started laughing. I said, oh, no, I've barely started it. And I remember after that, got back home, and I was very tired, of course, but I started reading this book. And the amazing thing reading this was, for one thing, this opening up. Remember, every book sort of opens our vision up a little bit more into the wizarding world through Harry, who sees more and more. But this is the first time. In the last book, he got to the Quidditch World Cup, and then, of course, went to the graveyard, which, you know, to him is almost just an extension of the maze. So the World Cup was his first real introduction to the larger wizarding world. All of us as fans had gotten our introduction into the larger wizarding world in Quidditch of the Ages and Fantastic Beasts, as we talked about last time. But here Harry discovers so much more of the good and the bad of the wizarding world. We're introduced to Grimmauld Place. That was the first time we'd been there. And of course, I was just thinking that there were things that we discovered in Book 5 which now seem like they're so much a part of the world of Harry Potter that it's hard to imagine. We waited to Book 5 to find out, for example, what the sleeping portraits in Dumbledore's office really were. The first time that we actually encounter them as talking as was in Book 5. Up until then, we didn't have anything. You know, we didn't have any picture of that. Just like we didn't know anything about apparating until the beginning of Book 4. It's a little strange because there's so many things which are new and different, and going to everything from, of course, the Ministry of Magic at the end, which was a huge eye-opener, but also just discovering Grimmauld Place, of course, but the going to St. Mungo's. All of these things which are just stepping out further and further into the world of the wizarding world around. And I tell you, I just have to mention this, that we already knew going into Book 5 that there was going to be this death. We didn't know who, but we that had come out. There was going to be this really important, really major death. I think the news had even reported that Rowling had said that when she wrote the scene of that death, she cried and how hard it was for her. And so we all came into Book 5 expecting someone to die. And interestingly enough, if you read it with that in the back of your mind, you'll realize that every couple of chapters we think somebody's dead. I mean, it happens over and over. Mr. Weasley, Mrs. Weasley, seeing everybody dead in her Boggart is you know. But our first impression is that we see somebody lying there dead. This happened over and over in the book. We constantly are being teased with the idea that someone is going to die, and then of course at the end it is in fact Sirius who's dead. But I have to say that Sirius' death did not bother me anywhere near as much as, and it's not exactly a death, but the scene in St. Mungo's, that's the chapter where, it's chapter 23, where they go and they run into Lockhart, and he's talking about, getting all the fan mail, and he doesn't even know why, and so that's funny, and we're laughing at that, but then there's Neville and his parents. And, of course, his gran, who treats everything so matter-of-factly. But I can remember reading that the very first time. I was sitting, actually, in my backyard, and I can still remember that feeling and the kind of the dappled sunlight from the tree and sitting there and reading this and weeping. I don't think anything in the Harry Potter books has affected me like that chapter did. And I think it was because, it brought the sadness and the loss and the horribleness of Voldemort and what he did and what he stood for so much into focus, so much more than, the rattling off of who got killed and all this kind of thing. I think right there was a moment which still, I still find it. I mean, I went back and read that chapter again, and I still tear up when I read this. And I think what it is this part of it is and again, just to talk again about the richness of Rowling's writing, part of it is when you see, when you come off of the humor of Lockhart, and I'm sorry, humor of the poor fellow who's lost his mind, but, it is written, you do laugh, Gladys Gudgeon writes me twice a week, and I wish I knew why. It's funny, and, sad but funny, and then all of a sudden, boom, you're dropped into that moment. And there's Neville and his gran who tells him, you know, you should be proud of your parents. But when his mom comes up and tries to hand him something, gran says, oh, yeah, whatever, just throw it in the bin. And Neville takes that gum wrapper and says, thanks, Mom. It's an amazing moment. It really is. It still is. And again, maybe another reason why I keep reading these books and I keep enjoying these books, and because they don't let go of you. They don't get old. They don't get. And honestly, when I read it, I know the next line. I know what's coming. I know if anybody was going to not be affected by reading a book, it would be me. I mean, I can hear Jim Dale's voice in my head when I read things. I know these books so well, but the fact that even under those circumstances, when I read a chapter like that, when I read things like that, I can still go there. I'm still lost in that magic. I guess going back to what Vicky wrote, that door is opened. I've tapped that brick, and I'm there in that world again. And it happens over and over. And, you know, I think especially of those of you maybe who haven't read the books that often, maybe just once or twice, and have seen the films, and, you know, I understand it's a lot of reading, but you owe it to yourself. Go back and read them again. And even if you don't read everything, I mean, I've people say, I'm going to read the entire series, and, you know, just one book at a time. Just one book at a time, and treasure it, savor it, because I can tell you from experience that the second or third time, that's still just as good. I had a teacher once who referred to books like that as pizza books. It's like pizza. You can always eat pizza again. And this is a book you can always read again, and it's always amazing and wonderful. So book five, though, was it amazing and wonderful first time through? Granted, chapter 23 was, but I have to say most of us, and if it's not true of you, more power to you. But for a lot of us, we read book five and sat there thinking, what in the world is this? This is not what we expected. This isn't a little bit more of the same. This isn't what happened to the whimsy. What happened to the fun? And not that it wasn't fun, because it was amazing, but what happened to our beloved Harry Potter world that we had figured out and analyzed and thought about? And what's going on here? Everything was changed. I said last time that in that gap, everything changed. But really, for the series, for the story, everything changes in book five. And it's not just that, okay, the war is on, and so everything gets darker and scarier, and it's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that Harry, at the end of book four, and I refer to him as superhero Harry. There he is again. He has all these things gathered up around him that make him, in his mind, and maybe in the mind of the wizarding world, that make him strong. He is this powerful, or going to be, he's becoming powerful, maybe he'll be able to take on Voldemort. And book five, everything that gives him that supposed strength gets ripped away from him. I mean, think about it. His image of his father as being this amazing, perfect person, this image which came through everything that happened in book, you know, three in particular, but think about his reaction to Snape. Snape, you are an awful person. My father was a wonderful person. Don't talk bad about my father. But then he sees this memory and realizes that Snape has reason to say that. Maybe not to the extent that he does, but his father is not perfect. His father did some pretty mean things. Other things that are gone. Privet Drive as being safe haven, even though he hates it there, but it's safe there. But it's not anymore. All of a sudden, there are Dementors flying around. All of a sudden, everything he thought was the way it was at the beginning there in Privet Drive is not true. Mrs. Fig, it turns out to be a part of the Wizarding World. All of this is thrown out. His ability to fly is gone. His broomstick gets taken away. He can't play Quidditch. This is the one thing that he claimed in Book 4 as his strength. He can fly. He used it against the dragon. That was his strength. Gone. His relationship with Dumbledore, another key part of his strength, is gone. Dumbledore won't even look at him, won't talk to him. Even at the beginning, his relationship with his friends, and he breaks that. But all of this is gone. He feels completely cut off from them, and then when he does get with them, keeps the distance for a while. All through the book, he keeps a distance from everything around him. And at the beginning, even Hogwarts appears to be gone, because he's going to be expelled. But then, of course, that gets taken care of. His relationship with the ministry. Up until, think about Book 3. Book 3, he was, he blew up his aunt and they let him go. He was the darling of the ministry. In Book 4, he was kind of the darling, but that started to crumble. Book 5, he's a complete enemy. The ministry, no longer, he's not going to get protection from the ministry. He's not going to get ministry cars to go bopping around London anymore. It's not going to happen. A lot of things get taken. I mean, even his dream of being an Auror, that's gone. Umbridge, you know, and Umbridge doesn't take it away. McGonagall says she's going to make sure it happens, but he realizes that it's almost going to be impossible because of his performance in Potions. But, you know, he's already learned that McGonagall does not have power over Umbridge, and Umbridge has made it clear he is not going to be able to be an Auror. And then, of course, as it goes along, Dumbledore actually is forced out of Hogwarts. So is McGonagall. These people leave. Hagrid. All these people are gone. Everyone who is his strength, everyone who has been around him, all the things that he sees as his power. And then this is the key. His saving people thing, as Hermione puts it, results in the death of Sirius. If he would have not trusted his charging to the rescue, his ability, he's going to go take on Voldemort in the ministry, and if he wouldn't have had that sort of an attitude, Sirius would not have died. And the prophecy would not have been recovered. All of the things that he was trying to fight for, using what he thinks is his strength, is gone. Not just the strength, but what he was fighting for. It fails. And at the end, it's very interesting. When you look at his final speech, or the final, I guess it's not a speech because it's internal to him, but his last scene there in Dumbledore's office, he says, and this is what it says, he doesn't want to be Harry anymore. And the fact of the matter is, he isn't. It makes me think, what's the first thing? Dumbledore walks back into his office, or walks back, comes in through the fireplace, but he comes back in, what's the very first thing he does? He takes Fox, the phoenix, who has gotten hit by the curse from Voldemort, and killed. He takes that little phoenix and puts it back in the ashes, and we see the phoenix start to emerge anew. And right away, I think of, it's almost Harry is reborn at this point, and it's not pretty. It's not nice. It's not good. He doesn't go lightly. I mean, if you've read, Voyage of the Dawn Treader, you'll recognize that same sort of a thing happening to you, Eustace, in that book, where he's turned into a dragon, and the only way that he can, not be a dragon anymore is to have that dragon exterior ripped away from him, and it's painful and it's horrible, but it out of that comes a new person. And it's like a caterpillar becoming a chrysalis. I guess you could think of Book 5 as being the chrysalis, and Harry emerges at the end, and not just at the end. I mean, if you read the book, it's not written so prosaically. Already through this, through the negative, he is also changing. And so you see him becoming a leader, becoming not a warrior leader, but a teacher. His role is a role of caring and nurturing of love and not of fighting and battling. And by the end of it, it's the first time you see him really happy since book three. I mean, it really doesn't happen until book six. Book six, and we'll talk about that soon, but book six is where everything finally does come together for him. But he is sorting out who he is, and he becomes someone new. If you look at, I love this reference. If you see symbolically, look at this plant thing, the Mimbulus Mimbletonia that Neville has. At the beginning, when you poke it, it sprays stink sap everywhere, and it's like nasty and strikes back. And at the end, we see the same thing. Neville's still holding it, and it says the plant has grown a great deal over the year, and now made odd crooning noises when touched. To me, that's one more symbol of the change that happened in this book. Now, and one last thing, and this is we'll kind of finish up with this, because there's so much more to talk about in book five, and I think I want to kind of go back to it, I think, in the next podcast and just talk some more about some of the things in here. But look at what happens at the very end of book five, and compare the very end of book five with the very end of book one. At the end of book one, Vernon Dursley goes walking off, and Harry kind of goes trotting after him. Well, this is the very end of book five. It says, this is after the Order of the Phoenix has turned up to have a word with the Dursleys. And again, now this is a good example. This shows the new Harry. We saw the new Harry coming already in book three when he talked back to Uncle Vernon. But in book four, he's developing a little bit more of what we find at the end, which is this sort of, you know, coolness, where he's detached from the Dursleys. But here's where it really happens. I'm going to just read the last paragraph. It says, Harry nodded. He somehow could not find words to tell them what it meant to him, to see them all ranged there on his side. Instead, he smiled, raised a hand in farewell, turned around, and led the way out of the station toward the sunlit street, with Uncle Vernon, Aunt Petunia, and Dudley hurrying along in his wake. Who's leading the way now? And so, at the very end of book five, we see this new Harry ready to start his path, this different path toward the final confrontation with Voldemort. We see it coming. We see him changed. Now, what he had to go through was horrible. And so we as fans, we read this and went, I mean, it's immensely gratifying to read about Umbridge getting her comeuppance. And little tidbits like, you know, McGonagall sort of, you know, quietly telling Peeves how to, you know, wreck something in the castle and things like this. There's amazing moments. But the first time through, the shock of it, if you will, was quite something. And to try to absorb all of that and think it through and understand and try to put it all together, it took a while. I think for a lot of people, the first time through, it wasn't a great experience. And that's not exactly the way to put it. It was an amazing experience, but it wasn't the same experience as reading one of the other earlier books. It was kind of like reading the whole graveyard scene in Goblet of Fire over and over. But gradually getting better. I remember the delight, this feeling of delight when he gives this the interview and it comes out in the Quibbler, and all of a sudden there's a change. All of a sudden we see that she's not winning. And I love that bit about, you know, she bans the Quibbler from, nobody is allowed to read it, and therefore everybody reads it. You know, Hermione laughs about that. She couldn't have, Umbridge could not have chosen a better way to make sure everybody read it, and which is funny because at that particular time, banning the Harry Potter books was a fairly popular pastime in some quarters, and so that was not lost on fans. the idea that Rowling was saying, well, you know, banning a book is the best way to make people want to read it. And people read it. Book 5 was an amazing progression forward in the Harry Potter series. And it's interesting because we're going to talk about this a little bit more coming up in Book 5 and maybe even more in Book 6. There was another big change that happened in the storytelling. And I think maybe we'll wait and we'll save that for the next time around. And we'll talk about that a little bit more, about how Book 5 turned a corner when it came to telling the story. So I'm not done rereading Book 5. I'm going to start it, pick it up again, keep reading, and I'm also reading Book 2 at the same time, mostly because I'm in the process of writing The Reader's Guide to Chamber of Secrets. I'm going to throw in a plug here. If you're interested in some more of these kinds of notes and background information, the Lexicon Reader's Guide to Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone is available. That is an e-book. It's available for the Kindle. It's also available for the Nook. And so, by all means, check that out. As I said, I'm hoping to get the Lexicon book itself available this summer. There's some editing that has to be done, but that shouldn't be too tough of a job. And then also, make sure that you check out the website. Check out the Facebook page, by all means, because the fan page is great. We've had some good discussions there lately, and it's always great fun to kind of meet people on there. I've had a number of people email me after the last podcast when I mentioned that I would love to know people's real names on Pottermore so that I can add that as a nickname. You can do that on Pottermore when you have people who've accepted a friend request, but all you know is the screen name, which, of course, is assigned to you by Pottermore itself. And I had a number of people send emails and messages, and so now I've changed the nickname on there to their real name. So that's kind of nice. If I ever get a chance to run into you in one of those chapters, we'll know that we're reading the same thing together at the same time. Another thing that I'm going to do, and if you're listening to this podcast long after it was recorded, it's probably too late for you, but on Google Plus, you can do something called a Hangout. And a Hangout is basically a video chat. And I'm thinking of putting one of those together at some point, hopefully this week, later in the week perhaps, still working out some of the technical details of that. Just as an opportunity for everybody to sit and talk a little bit about the Harry Potter books, we'll choose a topic and we'll just, instead of all just listening to me tell what I think, we'll have a chance for everybody together to kind of throw in their ideas and discuss some things, and gives an opportunity to get a lot of different insights into the books. So definitely keep your eyes open for that. I'll be announcing it on the Facebook page when I decide to do that, and of course on Google Plus, which is where it'll happen. If you want to contact me, let me know your Pottermore handle, or just send some of your ideas the way that other people have. My email address is steve.lexicon@gmail.com, and you can follow me on Twitter. That's lexicon_steve. But and by all means, head for the fan page on Facebook. And, of course, check out the Harry Potter Lexicon website. I keep getting emails from people. I've had these emails for years from people who say they get started reading the Lexicon, and before they know it, it's an hour or two later, and they've just gone from one link to the next and been reading essays and reading all this information that's packed in there. And, yes, some of it is a little bit older. Some of it has not yet been updated for reasons that I've mentioned. But I keep working at it, and I keep editing, and It's always good for people. People send me emails with things that they've spotted that need to be updated, and I always tell them I'll update them as quickly as I can, but I have quite a list of those kinds of things to do. But by all means, check that out. Look for the show notes on the Lexicon website itself, and you'll see some links to some of the things we've been talking about. So that's about it for episode 11. As I said, there's still a lot to talk about in Book 5, so I think next podcast, which should come within a week or so, we will revisit Book 5 and talk a little bit more about that book before we move on to the rest of the series. So that wraps it up for now. This is Steve Vanderark of the Harry Potter Lexicon, and as always, thanks for listening.